the words of blessings and presence, so we can gain as much awareness of what's already taking place among us today on the very special occasion of Baladev Purnima. At least for most, some of us, we're celebrating that on this part of the world. And Raksha Bandhana. Magyanatimirandasya Chakshurunmilitam Jinatasmi Shri Gurave Namah Nama Shrishtam Anumapi Satriputram Matrasarupam Rupam Tasyagrajamarupurim Mathurim Gastavatim Radhakundam Giribaram Mahoradhika Madhavasam Praptoyasya Pratitagripaya Shri Vancha kalpatarubhyascha kripa sindhubhyaiva cha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaha Nikhila shruti mole ratnamaladiti nirajita padapankajanta ajimukta kulai rupashyamanam paritashtam harinam samshrayami kelo dunita kedaya bishadaya Pranmila Damodaya Samyak Shastra Vibhadaya Rasadaya Chitarpitunmadaya Sasvat Bhakti Vinodaya Shramadaya Madhurya Sri Chaitanya Nidhedaya Tavadaya Bhuyadamandodaya Vande Sri Krishna Chaitanya Nityananda Sahodito Gudadaya Pushpapanta Chitra Sangrutamonudo Nilam bodhitati sadasvabiraha kepambitam bandhavam Srimad Bhagavati kathasamandiraya sanjeevayam bhatiya Srimad Bhagavatam sadasanayana shrupajanay pujayam Rasa Ghanamohana Murtim Vichitra Kilimahotsavulasitam Radha Charana Viloditam Ruchira Srikandam Harim Bande Vrindavaneshwarita Vaiva Padarabindam Premamritai Kamakarundara Soghapurnam Hridyarpitam Madhupatir Smaratapamogram Bhaktya vihinaya paradha lakshay chiptaschakamadittarangamadhyem kripamayitvam sharanam prapanam vrindenmaste charanarabindam svastyastu vishvasya kalu prasidatam yayantu bhutani shivanmito diya Manashtabhadram bhajatada dokshaye abeshyatam numatirapiyahaituki. Sri Sachinandan Gaurhari ki jai, Sri Harinam Prabhu ki jai, Gaudiya Vaishnav Guru Parampara ki jai, Samaveda Bhaktavrinda ki jai, Sri Baladev Purnima ki jai, Sri Rakshabandhan ki jai. Gaur Premanand, Hari Hari Bol. So, pranam to all of you. Greetings from Dijon in France. We've been here for the last day or so. Before that, 2 days traveling with Uddhav Prabhu in a few sacred spots, sacred sites, some monasteries in France. So, yeah, just finished some celebration of Baladev Purnima with some local devotees. And now continuing the celebration, overflowing into this meeting with all of you, being carried by the current of grace to meet with our weekly tribe, weekly family, and welcome to those of you who are connecting for the first time. So as usual, we invite for questions, quest, comments, ideas you may have to share. I'd like to share a few brief words before that, if you allow me, on the sacred occasion of Sri Baladev Purnima, though the lecture has been streamed, so it's already there online, the one we gave just a few minutes ago here. But yeah, we were reflecting, trying to make the celebration of Baladev Purnima something as as committing as possible to our own life and practice, right? So it doesn't end up being a folk tale or some type of complex theological narrative that has nothing to do with our day-to-day life. So how in which ways the appearance of Sri Balaram speaks to us, whatever we may be on our journey. So the reflection went into the direction of exploring basically the name of Balaram. The words Balaram, right? Bala means strength and Ram means pleasure. So Balaram, he's he who finds pleasure in showing his strength. And this doesn't mean only weightlifting, right? We know Balaram is pretty powerful in daily wrestling in the Leela of Raj, but we were trying to take more to a level where we can relate in our current stage of the journey in terms of Baladev being Akanda Guru Tattva, or let's put it this way, God as an Acharya, God as a guru, God teaching by example, and how strength comes again, not so much from weightlifting as it comes from coherence, living our lives, aligning thoughts, words, and actions. The more we are aligned with these three, the more powerful we become, basically. The more impactful our walking on this earth becomes, so to say. Impactful in every direction, even attracting God's heart, Krishna's heart. No? So we were speaking about exploring these implications of Balaram deriving pleasure from his showing the strength, being proper example of aligning with truth, being a servant of Bhagavan, being Krishna himself, if you will, if you want to speak in non-dual terms. Bhagavan, Krishna and Balaram are both God, right? So we don't go to run too much into polytheism, so we have to be careful when we have our endless array of deities in our tradition. Many times we have to remind ourselves, Advaita Tattva, right? The ultimate reality is non-dual consciousness. So our Das avatar and this other manifestation and other are the same person in its endless emotional expressions. And Balaram is, interestingly, the color of Balaram. Each one of these manifestation of the divine have a certain color, and colors are related to emotional dispositions as well. Every color speaks of a mood. So Balaram's color, technically speaking, is crystal. So it's transparent, basically, interestingly. So that's the color of Balaram, who represents Guru Tattvam. We were exploring how, yeah, Guru Tattvam invites for transparency. No? The Bhagavatam, for example, says, Vedatvam sumyatat sarvas tatpatam tadanugrahat dujusnik dasasisya gurabhoguhyam apyuta. When the disciple is sincere and transparent, Sri Guru, being pleased with that student, showers that person, revealing all the secrets of life. But the implication is that the guru is transparent to begin with, of course. No, it's not just teacher demanding transparency from students while gurus do not hold themselves accountable or do not are willing to be as transparent as possible. Again, guru tattva, guru, vyasti guru, individual gurus are representatives of the Samasti agency of Guru embodied by Balaram, who is crystal, like the crystal, is transparent, sincere, coherent, if you will. So those who represent that agency are invited to, whether as guru or as sishya, because when we say parampara, we are saying guru sishya parampara. It's teacher student. So transparency and coherence is invited for all of us equally. And that's the actual bala, the actual strength that we are talking about, and the actual pleasure, Balaram, the actual pleasure that the actual higher taste we are invited to relish, no? By exhibiting proper strength, by exhibiting proper coherence, aligning with these principles. Many times our pursuit of pleasure takes us in directions where we think one thing, we say another thing, and we act another thing. Because the way we are looking pleasure is to too fragmented or too misaligned. Sometimes the pleasures we want in our minds, we do not dare to speak about them. Right. Or we say some things and then we end up doing something else. So the ideal pleasure is that which you don't need to hide, so to say. You don't need to keep in secrecy. You don't need to embrace in a fragmented, fractured way, but it can be all one part of one same current, dhara. So anyhow, we have been reflecting for the last hour or so with the local family here about how we can speak or think and praise Sri Balaram, Sri Baladev Prabhu, in a way that, again, invites us for, extends an invitation to us from wherever we are to embrace a life of more and more coherence. It's a gradual process. It's not that you are incoherent or fully coherent. We are all in the journey of more and more alignment and more peace and more higher pleasure in living a genuine life. And of course, we couldn't avoid tying all that with learning to be vulnerable and present ourselves for who we are. There is no need for masks. There is no need for religious personas, but just being who we are and being coherent with that and knowing that that's enough. That's enough for Krishna, so it should be enough for us as well. But we have that interesting paradox. No? What's enough for Krishna is not enough for us. Now, Krishna is telling you, you are enough. I love you as you are. And I'm like, I'm not enough. It's never enough. I should be perfect. And Krishna is, relax. No, relax. You have thousands of masks put on your face and back and shoulder. That must be so suffocating. That must be so exhausting. Take a break from that. Relax. You're enough for me. And we are very good at stubbornness. We have a Nobel Prize at stubbornness as conditioned souls. So yeah, the invitation is Sarva Padi Vinir Muktam. Throw away all the masks possible. Try to be coherent, try to be aligned, try to be transparent, crystal-like, in front of he who is transparent, and let all our dealings be based more and more, at least, on transparency. Transparency is enough. Crystal clear, right? You say that expression, crystal is enough. So anyhow, I could go online coming from the momentum of that lecture, so I could basically repeat the lecture again. That's not the idea here. Is there available for those who would like to go there? So I just want to mention a few words. And of course, we connected that with Raksha Bandhanam, this tying of protection that sometimes is done between seniors or elders and juniors, older brothers, younger sisters, guru, disciple. And we concluded reflecting on how it can always be reciprocal, because in the same way that a guru is protecting the disciple by his example and teachings, a sincere disciple is protecting the guru in his own way, in the sense of inviting for a relationship of transparency and sincerity. That's a protection in itself, an invitation to for sincerity and transparency is in itself shelter. And guru is always learning from a disciple as well. So it's a mutual reciprocal exhibition of affection, so to say. And Baladev is guru par excellence. Baladev is the deity of Sakya Rasa. And our relationship with Sri Guru should evolve into one of friendship, as Rupa Goswami says. So all this tied together, right? Baladev, crystal clear, transparency, Akanda Guru Tattva, Sakya Rasa, friendship, Raksha Bandhanam, protection, being ourselves. So that's our daily prayer, hopefully. That's our daily attempt, getting closer and closer to this portal. So that's it. We'll move forward to the raised hands. Since I'm excited to hear you, to what you have to share today, what would you like to bring to the table? We are all together sitting at the round table. Try to visualize that, though Zoom is not offering that facility yet, but maybe there is a special paid plan that will offer that. You have to research that. We can see each other sitting in a circle and a table, and everyone brings some contribution to the feast, to the banquet.
Or so the first one. Or invent it.
Sorry?
Or invent it. Someone needs to invent it.
So we'll begin with Tom. He has the first raised hand. And you are driving, Tom, so I hope you can.
You can.
We don't see you yet.
Now we can. Do you see me?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
But I'm hearing myself as well.
Now yourself? It's good.
Now it's okay. Now I'm not hearing myself again. It's good.
Okay. All right. Haribol, Maharaj, how are you?
I'm doing fine now, seeing you better
Good.
even.
So I've been ruminating on this idea of the imagination in the role in the life of a sadhaka. Like, what is the significance or the role of imagination in the life of a sadhaka? For me personally, I've been kind of developing a bit of a negative conception of imagination regarding my sadhana of late. One reason is because, well, a lot of shastra seems to like admonish that like innate impulse to like imagine something, you know, like whatever shastra is telling us, like, you know, about the glories of chanting Nam, or, you know, the holy Dham, or like Krishna's Leela. You know, it always seems to be followed up by, this is not imagination. This is not imagination. So, you know, that's been, you know, that's left a mark in my consciousness. As well as, you know, I'm like, the only time I feel like I really utilize my imagination is when I'm like kind of triggered by like lust or like material desire, and I'm imagining enjoying some kind of sense object that my senses are coming in contact with, you know, and it always refers me back to that verse in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna delineates all the steps to falling down, you know, and I feel like that dwelling on sense objects, like that's kind of like the beginning of the end, you know, to falling down. So I've really been like kind of witnessing myself like keeping my imagination at bay for the most part, and not really like indulging in it, utilizing it. And perhaps the one aspect that I might utilize my imagination now is really to like try to manifest some like spiritual goal that I have. You know, because I feel like that's like an important part of manifesting, you know, something that we like desire in our heart, you know. But then I'm not even I'm kind of ambivalent about that too. Like, I'm not sure if that's the correct approach. Oh, okay, sorry. Yeah, so that's pretty much all I had to say.
Okay.
I was curious about what you thought, and you know, how you conceptualize the imagination in the role of sadhana.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Tom. That's a good question, and one that I've heard often. It comes at times. And again, as I like to say, usually imagination is in one sense just a word, right? So how we understand the word, what do we do with the word, that's what generally makes the difference. So how to define imagination, that would be the first step, because we may be talking about imagination and one person would may be thinking one thing, one person may be thinking another thing. In one sense, the origin of the word imagination, as it's already tied, still tied, it's come from the word image, right? So imagination, image comes to picture a picture to oneself, to picture oneself in a certain way. Once seeing oneself image in a particular way, the mind's faculty to form a particular image of yourself. So that's not necessarily the same as sheer, how to say, wild speculation. So that's why I want to make that distinction initially. Again, some may use imagination to refer to unlimited speculation without any boundaries and without any context. But I think the actual word, the origin, the original intention of the word imagination has more to do with one's image and picturing in one's mind the capacity of the mind to picture oneself in certain ways or in different ways. That can be fictional, that can happen in a, let's say, in a disciplined perimeter. No, that can happen in a certain context, which is legal, so to say. For example, each one of us have unlimited potential as souls. So we can imagine, imagine not as fantasy, but as different possibilities in which our potential may take shape. And I'm not saying even here about thinking, am I a gopi? Will I be a gopa? Will I be? But you can just think about your darkest potential and your brightest potential. And you can be picturing yourself going in those two directions and trying to visualize what's the best possible version of myself and what's the worst. not that we want to go to the worst, but sometimes it's humbling to, as we were talked a few times, it's humbling to realize where we can end if we were just to allow that to happen. Not to be neurotic either, but to be careful. So that will be, for me, imagination employed in the service of caution, so to say, and sobriety and humility. And then from there, you can go to your brightest potential. You can imagine all that you can be. I wouldn't use the word imagine there as something unreal. It may be unreal in the sense that that particular potential is not actualized yet, but it's within the perimeter of possibilities. Right? So again, it all depends how we are using, how we are employing the term. Mm-hmm. So again, I'm sitting here with you and I can imagine what will happen if I wake up at this moment from the class, and probably most of you will be confused why he woke up and left. And I just ran from the room shouting. I won't do that, relax. But I can imagine. It hasn't happened, so in that sense, it's not factual reality, but I can allow that to happen. So I can imagine the unfolding of that sequence, and that can become true. In fact, many times, many of the things that become true start with some imagination. If you want to use the word dreaming, I don't know. You can use another word if it helps better. I remember one. Albert Einstein said that, the following quote, and here is a pretty intelligent guy saying this. He said, imagination is more important than intelligence. Right? He was pretty intelligent. But above that, he was a dreamer in many ways. He dared to imagine things. He dared to allow himself to conceive possibilities, which in one sense were not yet actualized, were not yet real in one sense, at least in the concrete real. but the gesting of the whole process start many times in imagination. Like, let's say you identify yourself due to toxic shame as a useless, unworthy entity. In one sense, we could say that's imagination. That's not true, but you are fully identified with that. Therefore, you feel like that. You feel miserable. You feel all the things that you feel when you have that type of self-image. Now, you imagine, no? Because that's the truth for you at that moment. So you dare to imagine, imagination, image, to portray yourself in a different situation where you are not ashamed of yourself, where you don't feel worthless, where you are whatever. We live a dignifying life. And maybe that imagining of that possibility is what starts to give you some hope. Oh, and it doesn't mean that necessarily you are deceiving yourself, right? Like you are creating a parallel universe to avoid reality. Maybe that's how the actualizing of that possibility begins, by imagining, oh, that's possible. Such a thing is possible. So you start to entertain that on, if you will, to call that on the dream world level. But then that gives you an experience, that gives you prospect, that gives you hope. And then you start probably to take steps into actualizing that possibility, actualizing that potential, till hopefully it becomes concrete reality. Mm-hmm. And so there you have a very positive role of imagination, if we want again to understand imagination from that place. So I think there is place for disciplined imagination on a very different level, but related. I remember talking with Sam DeBoat some years ago in terms of practices like some Gaudiya Vaishnava circles have and other traditions in their own way, in terms of meditating on themselves, serving Radha and Krishna in the Leela, no, and them having a particular identity there, and reinforcing that sense of identity by repeatedly seeing themselves in that situation. And of course, there are many also in nowadays, current science also will say that, like if you start to quote unquote imagine certain pattern or certain emotion or certain way of seeing yourself, and you reinforce that on a daily basis with some discipline, in one sense that becomes actualized. No, that replaces your previous imagination, if you want to use that experience, because we could say also that you could say whomever, however we see ourselves now, that's in one sense a byproduct of some type of imagination. So we were talking about how there is place for someone who engages in this type of meditation. You may not be there yet, but there is a longing in that direction. And there can be some spontaneity and creativity in how you see yourself serving in that realm. Mm-hmm. But they come from a sincere place. Mm-hmm. Again, we have these examples in our tradition of devotees offering in their minds things that they cannot offer physically to Krishna. You want to call that imagination? You can call it. But if it comes from a genuine place, Krishna is accepting the offering, right? In fact, strictly speaking, in Archana, our worship of the deity, to say that whatever you offer physically, you have to first offer that in your mind. Because at the end of the day, it's all about offering your inner world through external things that may help us to offer ourselves internally. So again, I can in this moment start to imagine, if we want to use that word, me offering to Radha Krishna something in particular in my mind with as much sincerity as I can. Is that delusion? Not according to Radha and Krishna themselves, right? So again, for some people, they may choose to use another word, not imagination, because they relate the word to something utterly negative, but the word itself by its very definition do not necessarily speak in that direction. So again, I will try to make the point that there is place for that. That actually, not only there is a place, but disciplined imagination in a certain context and perimeter, there is a place for that. There is a place for that. There is a place for, I don't know, you hear certain leelas of Bhagavan or certain loving interactions, and you can imagine that this and because this and this happens, probably this and that will also be happening in that context, whatever that may be. And again, it can, if it happens in a disciplined context where there is no rasa basa and no very opposed emotions or conceptions, there is place for that. Mm-hmm. With this, I'm not saying you just come day one to the temple and just be free in your imagination and think whatever you want. First, we may need to put our imagination in context, basically. So those are some words that I'm sharing. And it's interesting because these last days I finished reading one book by Richard Rohr, on St. Francis, because I recently went to Assisi, as you may know, and I wanted to be a little bit more drenched into all that Francis is about. And there he has a whole chapter in the book. I don't recall the name now. It's something like imaginal causality. Very interesting. Now he's speaking about the imaginal causality. And speaking about how our imaginal world operates, and not imaginal as the same as imagination in this in the net in a negative way, he uses this different. For example, imaginaria, they have this Latin word. Imaginaria means like unconscious, our unconscious but operative worldview, which constructed by there are symbols, there are archetypes, speaking in Jungian terms, there are memories that inhabit it. Which have very concrete effects on us. And so they use the word imaginarium, how different people in different religious traditions have, different archetypes and symbols in their subconscious, and that takes them to relate and conceive of the divine in a particular way, which it doesn't mean it's false. It's just a particular way that they have some scars. We may use the word some scars or impressions that make us predisposed to conceive or relate. I mean, a Christian generally, I'm talking in general, they won't probably have a revelation of Balaram and the Gopas in Sakyarasa, for just to say. And a dedicated Gaudiya Vaishnava may not have a vision of Muhammad or something, because it's not part of their imaginarium, religious imaginarium, just to give an example in connection to that. So anyhow, some thoughts in this connection, but I hope we've had a relatively clear difference between imagination in a healthy, even holy, sacred, disciplined way, and unrestrained mental speculation, if you want to use those words, so to say, which even speculation is not a bad word if you study the origin of the word. But many times these words have some historical weight attached to that, and we need sometimes to deconstruct them a little bit and rediscover them over and over again. So I hope that helps,
Yeah, I
Tom.
think, yeah, no, that was wonderful. I'm always amazed by you. You know, I bring up this idea, this imagination, and you know the origin of the word, and you're able to, you know, elucidate, you know, that whole other side to it, which is, you know, it's a real revelation. And just the idea of it being having like a positive connotation when it comes to potential, to our potential and the possibilities, that's really that's affirming for me. You know, that's 'cause I think I intuitively do feel that it is positive in that when used in that way. So to hear you say that is definitely reaffirming. And
I'm just confirming what your gut is already telling you.
I mean that's
I'm
a
in the
beautiful
service of in this I'm in service to your gut. Thank you.
that's why this is always a beautiful this is why that's why it's always a beautiful dynamic, you know, it's always a beautiful exchange because of that,
It
because of
is.
that, the essence of the dynamic. So thank you. Thank you,
Thank you.
Maharaj.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom. We ap appreciate your question. And since we appreciate your question so much, we'll invite each of you for a minute to join us into what we like to call not so much breakout rooms, but breakthrough rooms. There may be some breakout and some breaking open. For those who are joining for the first time, we'd invite between two or three of us approximate groups, so we can share, continue churning whatever we've shared so far in this particular topic. And also it's an excuse to exchange our hearts, getting to know each other, continue to extend bonds in the family here in the Sangha. So I trust that it will be a very enriching experience. Please feel free to join, and we will be there for a few minutes. We'll see you back in a few minutes for the next question from Badra. Or well, Bhaktirasa has her hand raised as well, so we'll see who goes first. Okay, Bhaktirasa will invite you. You will receive an invitation. You can join the room. Attempt for bonding and connection. Great. Beautiful. So welcome back. Hoping you had a nourishing time together in your small chambers of heart sharing. And we'll continue with the next raised hand, which in the order, original order, was Bhakti Rasa. So Bhakti Rasa, invited to unmute yourself.
Thank you. Thank you. Hello, everyone. So I've been involved in kind of exploring the topic of grief and what that means. So I this morning I came up upon the reality that I need a new definition of the verse that says the wise person does not lament for the living or the dead. And at different times you had mentioned that it's about not lamenting for those things that are not worthy of lamentation. So I'm wondering if you can give some parameters, some healthy parameters as to what in our experience is not lamentable. Whereas many times it was pain at all that was considered lumped in there, that anything that caused us pain was something that was not lamentable and our pain was unworthy. So kind of wondering if you could give some parameters.
But you are the one who is immersed studying grief. You can share some thoughts first.
Well, one thing that came to my mind was what's not worthy of lamentation is the thought that lamentation is not worthy. That there is room to recognize pain as a valid thing. And what is not worthy is to lament that pain happened, and or to lament that there is pain, or that I have to go through pain experiencing difficulty in the world, that the experience itself is something bad and wrong and something to be gotten rid of, that is worthy of, you know, that the experience itself is worthy and that getting rid of it is not worthy of our lamentation.
Anything else?
That was all that came since this arose this morning. Right before I sat down for this sangha.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. We have to understand that section of the Gita in context also, right? And in context doesn't only mean which verse came before and which verse came after. not even which is the chapter in which the verse appears. Not even what chapter came before and which chapter came after, but even in which what happened after the whole battle of Kurukshetra, for example, because we can take Krishna and say and present him in a way that he's endorsing human impossibility, impossibility with A, not with O. Impossible means I'm beyond all emotion and all feeling. I'm untouched by anything. So we may think, oh, Krishna wants us to be like that, because we may think that he's like that, right? That sometimes is part of the answer. We already got wrong. No, Krishna doesn't feel anything. He's too beyond everything. So he wants to develop the qualities that God has on some degree. If he doesn't feel anything, he's too transcendental to feel stuff. Really? Are you sure? Have a glimpse at all that he feels on a daily basis in the Leela. And not only in the Leela again. So going back to the Gita, okay, it may seem from a casual reading that Krishna is endorsing why you are crying, why you are lamenting, why you are feeling, why you are grieving. Come on, get over that. Be transcendental. Now, you fast forward a little bit, Bhagavad Gita, Mahabharata, Kurukshetra war, millions of people dying, And after the whole thing ends, Krishna himself is engaged in part of the rituals and ceremonies for the deceased. And he's crying a lot there. Okay? So, again, he is a coherent God. So we must understand his do not lament in the context of his own lamentation. So he's crying. He's grieving the loss of so many people. He's grieving. He's sitting there grieving a lot. Again, Mahabharata describes he spends considerable time in that process. So it's not like, oops, I'm contradicting myself to what I say in the Bhagavad Gita. I have to make this business quick. Few tears, let's move forward. No, it says that it's open grieving. Mm-hmm. So then we have to go back to those words, do not lament, and see them in context. And okay, what does he mean by that? Mm-hmm. Which type of lamentation is not worthy of lamentation? What you say, Bhaktirasa, it's an interesting perspective of that, and it's a valid one. Of course, you are asking me, what will that mean for us? And I cannot give an answer to that because each one of us is in a different stage. So what some people need to grieve about in certain amount of time and quantity and quality, some other people may require different treatment of that, which I wouldn't say it's absolute non-grieving, but it can take different forms and times and periods. So I will say that do not lament. Of course, he's speaking about the wise. He's speaking about, and by wise, he's meaning enlightened beings. So he's not saying they do not lament, but they lament from a relatively enlightened perspective. And, or not relatively, it can be absolutely enlightened perspective. It doesn't mean that they do not lament, but they can understand what's going on, what's taking place. No? So, I don't know, let's give an example. I remember this example given by Houston Smith. Maybe you know him. He wrote this book called The World's Religions. Famous scholar, and speaks about all the different main religions in the world. And I remember in that book, he gives an example of a child, and then he goes to an adult child. So he says, for a child is playing with a car, a toy car, and the car broke, or whatever, the toy broke. And for the child, that's the end of the world, literally. The child subjectively experiences the breaking of the toy as apocalypse or something like that. It's the end. Now, there's nothing else apart from that toy breaking. There is not a bigger picture. There's nothing. That's it, right? And he will make that very clear. And again, of course, a child is a child. You cannot expect the child, you cannot as a parent tell your kid, come on, get a bigger picture. There are more things in life waiting for you. When you will be my age, and he will go even more crazy when he hears all that stuff. No? So that's, he needs to lament for that loss in that degree, in that way. Now he gives the example, now we are grown-ups and we may not cry about our little toy car, but still we may grieve or lament out of material attachment, excessive attachment, a similar version of that. Maybe it's not a toy car, now it's the car. It's not a toy, it's a car I use. But someone like, mark my car, and my whole week is ruined, and I'm lamenting excessively, and I want to kill the person, or I want to kill myself because my car is not the ideal car anymore, whatever. So he gives the example that there is not much difference between those two examples. Now, so he tries to speak about that ideally, again, from a sage perspective, that's an avoidable lamentation. Of course, if you are not enlightened, you will lament in that way. You cannot avoid doing that. You cannot press a button and force yourself to be an enlightened sage, right? So again, the verse is speaking from the perspective of an enlightened being. Mm-hmm. And let's be honest, sometimes we can have some amount of knowledge. We can even have some amount of realization. And we may be experiencing in a particular situation in which we get overwhelmed. And there is place for that, but also there is a place for someone tapping on our shoulder and saying, don't forget there is a bigger picture out there also. No? Like, okay, lament whatever you need to lament, but then see the bigger picture. And that's basically what Krishna allows to do, Arjuna. He's not repressing Arjuna's emotions. The first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita is Arjuna's lamentation. Krishna doesn't have a time to put a word into it because it's Arjuna speaking and crying and becoming desperate and going all the whatever he feels he needs to feel. And eventually he finds himself in a particular place where he feels, I don't know what to do. I need some help, some guidance. So that's when Krishna starts to speak and somehow starts to remind Arjuna who Arjuna is, so to say. So it's a way of telling Arjuna, you can do better than this. I'm not against your grieving, but you are a sage. Arjuna is a warrior sage. So he has a vision. So that's also a message for us. We can have on a normal day certain vision, a certain degree of sobriety, but something can happen and it seems that we have lost all that in that moment. And we get really overwhelmed by a particular situation, and lamentation is part of that. And again, it doesn't mean we have to cancel that altogether, but also there is a place for a well-wisher and a friend at some point of that process to, again, tap on our back, on our shoulder, and remind us there is something more beyond this. So even while you may need to go through this, there is something bigger. No? And let's be honest, sometimes we can get too identified with our lamentation and just live there. So our whatever. And I wouldn't say that's because you still need to grieve and grieve and grieve. Sometimes we just over-identify with a certain thing that happened to us. And that's what sometimes we call unnecessary victim consciousness. Let's put it that way. Maybe you were a victim. So we have nothing against that. Let's say someone went through some situation of abuse. So you were legitimately a victim. And you need to go, one needs to go through that at that stage. Well, many times is that those who were a victim, they do not consider themselves a victim in the beginning. Sometimes children who were raped, they think it was their fault or something like that. So they first need to properly assess the situation as I was abused and I was a victim. And then one moves to the stage of survivor of the victim, of being a victim. And then you can become a hero eventually. So it's victim, survivor, hero. But you need to go through this stage. You cannot, like this, you cannot remain a victim forever. In that case, that will be an unnecessary lamentation. You continue to cry over what happened to you 50 years ago. And in that context, you are not surviving the experience and becoming all that you can be. And I'm not, by saying that, we are not judging or condemning that people, but it's just pointing to, as lamentation and grieving has a very crucial role, there's also a place to know when to move forward. And of course, if we will lament from a healthy place, we will naturally move forward through the lamentation itself. But sometimes we see that will be another way of thinking. If you lament and lament and lament, in one sense, you've never actually lamented properly. Right? So if I'm still, quote unquote, grieving for something that happened three lifetimes ago, probably means I actually never grieved in the deepest, genuine, vulnerable, open place. And it's just a toxic form of victim consciousness and blaming and self-centeredness in some way. So I will say that's another way to understand how Krishna is saying the wise do not lament for this, for that. They do not become over-identified and carried by those things and just create the whole persona out of that to the point that they forget who they actually are. And they do not, how to say, in the context of that crying and lamentation, unconsciously they find the perfect excuse not to grow and not to embrace their potential and not to be all that they can be, because this happened to me. And again, I want to be sensitive saying all this because I know some of us, probably most of us, have gone through complex situations, and I'm not insulting anyone going through that, but just making the point that, we can always find some excuse not to grow, whether in the name of past trauma or in the name of success or in the name of everything is fine. I mean, self-deception can take so many shapes. So that's basically the spirit, right?
Yeah, thank you. And as you were speaking, so many things rose to the surface. One of them is connected to, in Evolution and Divine Love, you speak that we seem to have so many problems, but at the root of all problems is the experience of a lack of love. So the wise person, the person who is witnessing our suffering, our pain, knowing that, then they can direct us to the proper source of the pain. It's not the broken toy car. It's what that broken toy car meant to us, and how it losing that felt like a loss of love somehow. And same thing with the other cars. So that way we can disentangle ourselves from the particulars and really tend to the real pain that's underneath the particulars of how it's showing up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because at the end, the broken car is a mirror of our own brokenness. So we are not whole enough. So we need to over-identify with something outside of us. And if that's broken, we are broken. So, and again, you can be an adult and still be in the same pattern. So we need to gain proper wholeness. So whatever is breaking outside of us, so to say, is not breaking us, no? So yeah, Sage will try to point to that, to those type of things. And again, in that context, the sage will witness our grief, or our, even if you want to call it a necessary lamentation, and they will feel compassion for that. So they will have their own form of pain in witnessing that. But it's, again, it's a pain that is expanding the heart. No? It's, if you will, cracking us open. So the point is that, no, the pain, the suffering, the grieving, the lamentation, you name it, however you like, but is that making me more open, more present, or it's creating the opposite of that? So that's another way of judging the tree by its fruits, so to say.
And one last thing is how, yes, you mentioned a long time ago when you were talking about radical personalism, that the between denial, between blaming and denial is grief. So perhaps the unworthy lamentation is the blaming and the denial, or is the lamentation that's wrapped up in those two things, and not the lamentation that actually comes from the actual grieving.
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't say blaming and lamentation is wrapped up in blaming and denial is wrapped up in lamentation, but, oh no, how do you say it? Lamentation is wrapped up in blaming and denial, but I would say blaming and denial is wrapped up in lamentation, right? So yeah, I agree. There is a middle point, middle path, balanced, healthy grieving, and its other two toxic counterparts, which are two sides of the same coin, right? So yeah, it takes sincerity, it takes introspection, it takes paying attention to the fruits of the tree of that particular form of tears. And we can develop more and more, discernment about where is that coming. And again, many times it we require help also. It's not that we can figure everything just by ourselves. Thank God. So again, Krishna is trying to assist Arjuna in his journey. It's part of that template that Okay, you kind of figure out your own lamentation issues just by yourself. Sometimes feedback helps. No, as commonsensical as that sounds, we need sometimes feedback which is different from our own mind loop to get a different point of reference and see ourselves from another angle, especially if it comes from God, especially if it comes from a well-wisher guardian angel who have our best potential and best interest in mind. So that's really necessary to get back to a more sober idea of who we are actually. So yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Let's go one more time to the breakthrough room, since I think this is an important, interesting topic to explore all together a little bit, the dimensions of grief and unnecessary and necessary lamentation.